Hello, and welcome to Literally from the North Shore. Thank you for tuning in. Today, we will continue with Tom Kohler's reading of Minnesota author Dean Hovey's book, Whistling Pines, a lighthearted mystery set in a fictional Two Harbors senior care facility. We'll pick up where Tom left off last time.
A great weight had been lifted, and I saw his proposal as a great compromise. I pulled out the key, unlocked, and opened the door. No one's been near Axel, or the deceased, since I checked for a pulse, except for the nursing supervisor who checked his vital signs, and Len. I followed them until they stopped at the end of the short hallway where we stood staring at Axel's body. "There's a lot of blood spread around on the rug," Barnes noted. Harris said, "There are a lot of tiny bloody paw prints." "Actually, Axel's dog was going wild in there when I discovered the body, and he spread the blood around a lot. There's a pretty good puddle on his other side," I said. The deputies looked around the small living area. "Not much out of place other than the picture that fell down," Harris noted. Barnes added, "Sometimes we get to murder scenes and it looks like a bomb went off with upturned furniture and broken dishes." "Yeah," Harris replied. "Remember that one up in Isabella where it looked like the couple had emptied the cupboards, throwing plates and cups at each other?" Barnes was staring at the dining area that split the living room from the kitchen. "They didn't even upset the cards and cribbage board on the kitchen table. Must have been someone he trusted." I heard voices in the hall and returned to the sentry position to find a stream of senior citizens trooping down the hall toward me. Tucker was racing for his home, his leash trailing. I scooped up Tucker and walked toward them with my hands in the air. "Sorry, but there is nothing to see, and no one is allowed down here unless they're going to their room." Wanda Peltier, a blue-haired woman with an exaggerated dowager's hump, led the advance, pushing her rolling walker. "We heard that something happened to Axel, and there are cops all over the place," she said in her outdoor voice. Wanda always wore brightly colored scarves with floral designs. As always, the colors were carefully matched, and her light blue dress looked as if it had just returned from the dry cleaners. Some of the residents wore clothes that were at times a little threadbare or missing a button, but Wanda's appearance was always impeccable. "You all know that I can't comment on that," I said. "We have to abide by the HIPAA laws. I get fired if I told you anything about Axel's health." "Screw HIPAA," the words came from a voice in the back of the pack. The elevator had now disgorged a second load of senior citizens, all but one female. "Axel would want us to know what is going on," said Hulda Packer, a slight woman with thick glasses. Like most of the others, she wore a flower-printed dress. "Hey, what are you cops doing here?" Hazel Perkins asked, pushing her walker down the hallway. I turned as Deputy Barnes closed Axel's apartment. "Don't be stupid, Hazel," the lone man in the crowd, Wilfred Bud Larson, said. "They finally busted Axel." "Why would they bust Axel?" I asked. "Everyone knows about Axel," Hazel said. "I'm surprised he's gotten away with it this long." "Gotten away with what?" Deputy Barnes asked. Hazel started to comment and then hesitated. "It's not my place to say," she said primly. This seemed terribly out of character because Hazel was the hub of all rumors. After a moment of consideration, she said, "He is a philatelist." Her statement was made emphatically. Her heavily creased face took on a look that made it quite clear she was a force to be reckoned with. I was confused, but Deputy Barnes managed to brave the wrath of Hazel and asked the quintessential question, "Was he dealing in stolen postage stamps?" "Don't be stupid," Hazel snapped. "Stamps have nothing to do with this mess." "I think Hazel meant that he is a philanderer," Bud Larson offered in clarification. Hazel was a schoolteacher, but she sometimes has problems sorting her huge vocabulary. Axel is a widower, I replied. It hasn't been long enough, Hulda said. There hasn't been a proper grieving period. Enid's only been dead for 2 years. Her dentures clicked with her contemptuous words. Deputy Harris put his hands up. That's the end of the show, folks. We're creating a fire hazard, and you all have to clear the hallway. He advanced towards the group, shooing them back to the elevator, assisting Hazel with the redirection of her walker. Once the elevator doors closed on the first group, I retreated to Axel's door with the two deputies. Harris put on his best glare, intimidating the remaining seniors into not looking back at us. I think that hell hath no fury like a woman scorned, Barnes suggested, as the last person climbed aboard the elevator. You mean Hazel? I asked, somewhat repulsed by the thought of her having an affair with someone. My dad was in a senior apartment building for a while, Barnes said, and he was quite the Casanova. He said that any man who owned a car, had decent night vision, and didn't smell was blessed with an endless supply of widows who were willing to pay for restaurant dinners and a glass of port in their apartment afterwards. I think it's going to take a while to get the mental picture of your father sipping wine with the widow Preston out of my head, Harris said. I also bet that the nursing supervisor knows what medications Axel's been taking, Harris offered. I imagine we'd run up against the HIPAA if we didn't have a court order to look at the list, I said, thinking of the training that we'd been given that specifically stated that punishment up to and including termination would be given for violation of the federal patient privacy laws. I'm sure that the crime lab will dust everything in the apartment, said Harris. They will know if there are any little blue pills in there. More interesting might be how often he was getting refills. Barnes was rubbing Tucker behind the ear, eliciting a display of near ecstasy from the dog. Tucker's eyes rolled back as he made a noise that almost sounded like a purr. Is this the pup that tracked blood all over the place? Harris asked. Yes, I said. I could hear him barking when I got out of the elevator. He was frantic when I opened the door. I can't imagine what was going on in his walnut-sized brain, but he knew something was very wrong. Barnes turned his head and looked at the irregular pattern of white, brown, and black that made up Tucker's wiry coat. He's the size of a basset hound with the short legs and long ears, but he's got a shaggy coat. What kind of dog is he? Axel said that he was a basset, St. Bernard mix, I replied. He told me that Tucker was symbolic of the little guy's triumph over the big guys. Harris frowned. I don't see how that's even possible. I could believe a basset and a beagle, but a St. Bernard seems impossible. Barnes shook his head. I hope the basset was the dad. Now I've got this mental image of a hound standing on a little stool, Harris said as he started to laugh. Barnes shook his head and said, that almost cancels out the image of my dad and Widow Preston. Whistling Pines, Chapter 2. It was nearly 7 p.m. by the time I got home. The hubbub of police, coroner, Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, Mobile Crime Lab, deputy sheriffs, and all the Whistling Pines management staff made for a scene of chaos rivaled only by the July 4th parade when Lizzie Petrone's scooter malfunctioned and ran through the trumpet section of the Moose Lake High School marching band. It would have been almost comical if not for the fact that Axel was removed from the building in a hearse while the residents were strategically moved into the dining room for an extended dinner. The answering machine's light was blinking red when I walked in the door. I hit the speaker button and listened to my mother, Audrey, admonish me for missing our regular Sunday evening phone call, then the recount of her charitable activities for the previous week as I peeled off my coat and hung it on a peg behind the front door. After my father's death, she inherited a trust fund account that allowed her to pursue pretty much anything that pleased her. Mostly what pleased her was giving her time and money to any group that involved the betterment of Duluth, from the Rose Garden Society to the Committee for the Preservation of Canal Park Architecture, the tourist area near the Duluth Lift Bridge. We spoke on Sunday evenings just to stay in touch. I decided that she'd probably vented enough in her two-minute message to last her a week. She really wouldn't want to know that I'd discovered a dead body, so I erased the message and didn't return the call. I really didn't feel up to cooking supper, so I was pleasantly surprised to find a chicken pot pie covered by a relatively thin layer of frost in the back of the freezer. Preheating the oven for the pot pie had the dual benefit of preparing dinner and taking the chill off the drafty kitchen in my old house. I was staring into the refrigerator, trying to identify a beverage that was neither expired nor evolving into a new life form, when the doorbell rang. When I opened the door, I found an angel and her child. Jenny was standing on the top step with a Culver's Butterburgers bag in one hand and a 12-pack of root beer in the other. She'd changed from her ducky smock into a pastel pink jogging suit. It managed to accent all of her many physical attributes. Her blonde hair was tied back in a short ponytail, and her round face had the glow of the recent removal of makeup. Her blue eyes lacked their usual twinkle, hinting at the stress she was feeling. "I didn't feel much like cooking," she said, as she handed me the root beer and pecked me on the cheek, "and I figured that you are probably in worse shape than I am." Jeremy, Jenny's tow-headed 8-year-old son, pushed past us into the living room. "Pete, why isn't your TV on?" he asked, as he pawed through the cushions of my 1960s vintage green couch looking for the remote. He had already peeled off a denim vest. His clothing choices were predictable: a T-shirt with some animated character that I failed to recognize, a pair of blue jeans worn through at the knees, and a pair of black tennis shoes with at least one flagging lace. He shared his mother's light complexion and blue eyes. Jenny told me once that Jeremy's father had been a Norwegian Air Force pilot, temporarily stationed at the Duluth Air Force Base. He'd swept her off her feet, but was back in Norway by the time Jenny discovered her pregnancy. A little detective work revealed that his wife and three young children lived just outside Oslo. She'd decided not to disrupt his life and to raise the little blonde boy by herself. I, on the other hand, am not a suave, handsome Norwegian pilot, but I am unmarried, employed, and considerate. I have the dark hair and blue eyes of my mother's Irish family and the disposition of my Swedish father, who never found any topic or situation so important to him that it deserved an argument. I tend to have a little of a hibernation eating pattern that causes me to pick up a few pounds when food is available, then to shed them when I have to cook for myself. Luckily, they seem to balance out, and I manage to keep my weight at 180 pounds, which carries well on my 6-foot frame. "Try the right side of the recliner," I suggested to Jeremy as Jenny carried the bag of hamburgers into the kitchen. Spotting the pot pie box, she said, "Please tell me you were planning to throw this in the garbage and got interrupted by the doorbell." She turned the box around and scraped off the layer of frost. "Pete, how can you even think about eating this? It expired in 2007. Even if it didn't make you sick, it has no remaining nutritional value." I was more interested in my growling stomach than the vitamins and minerals, I said, in defense of my sorry lifestyle. "I go back and forth between worrying that you'll come down with scurvy or that you'll die of food poisoning from eating something that's been incubating in the refrigerator 3 weeks, she said, gesturing at the kitchen. My guess is that the kitchen underwent a rehab at some point in history when avocado green was in vogue. The cabinets had been painted a darker shade that was more olive drab, and the floor and countertops had both been covered with the same gold and green linoleum. It all matched the green appliances and the gold formica table with matching gold vinyl chairs, all of it faded. I bought the house as is, including the dated furniture. Hey, if it isn't moldy and doesn't smell bad, what do I have to worry about? I asked as I pulled out 3 daisy-decorated garage sale plates. I was setting a can of root beer at each place setting. Do you have a glass of milk for Jeremy? Jenny asked. Not one that will pass a smell test. I gave the refrigerator a furtive look. What's wrong with root beer? He's a growing boy, she replied. Mom, can I eat in here? I don't want to miss this. They're down to the last 7 contestants. Jenny was just about to respond when I waved my arms and stopped her. That's fine, Jeremy. Just come here and grab a burger and take it with you, I said. I got a softer version of the look. As Jeremy grabbed a butter burger and a bag of fries, it took him less than 30 seconds to grab his load and be gone. What was that all about? Jenny asked as she unwrapped her burger. I need to talk about Axel, and I'd prefer to not have the conversation in front of Jeremy, I explained as I squeezed ketchup onto my burger wrapper and dunked a fry. Hazel came up while I was talking with the deputies and made some accusations about Axel's romantic side. Jenny pondered that as she ate a bite of burger and swirled a fry in the puddle of ketchup. I'm not sure that his romantic side had anything to do with his death. But you can't say that it didn't with any certainty. Maybe he had a jilted lover who was angry about the attention being paid to another woman. Do you know if Axel was having romantic excursions with other residents? I asked. Is this prurient interest, or is there a purpose to your question? Jenny hesitated and then added, Will I be able to tell the difference? I tried to give her my own version of the look, which was not nearly as effective. Len asked me to check around to see if there was anything going on that might be a motive for murder. So you're playing Watson to his Sherlock Holmes? That brought an image of Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce bantering inside Holmes's apartment. Most people thought Watson was only a foil for Holmes's brilliant deductions, while, in fact, Arthur Conan Doyle used Watson to ask the leading questions that added breadth to the investigation. I don't think I have that sort of relationship with Len. I'm just going to ask a few questions to see if something of interest pops up, I said. And you have still not answered my question about Axel's philandering. It's not philandering when his wife is dead, Jenny replied. Besides, it's not really any of our business. We ate in silence for a while. My mind was running through suspects and murder motives, and I failed to notice Jenny's silence. Jenny closed her eyes for a moment. When she opened them, they were filled with tears. I gently took her hand and pulled her to me. I was scared. You left me standing alone in Axel's room when you went to meet Len. I was freaking out. I knew that I was safe, but I couldn't even stand next to the couch out of fear the murderer would reach out and grab my ankle. We stood up and I held her close as Jeremy listened to the television around the corner. After a few minutes, she tipped her head back. You can be pretty nice to lean on. I pulled a loose strand of hair back from her face and tucked it behind her ear. Her face was flushed from crying, and I had a sudden urge to take care of her. Are you going to be okay tonight? Do you think there's a killer roaming around the halls looking for his next victim? She paused and then added, It'll freak me out every time I have to walk into someone's room to give them their medicine. I think that the whole place will be crawling with cops. You'll be safer at work than you are at home, I said, holding her close and nuzzling her hair. Will you be able to sleep tonight? I'll make a cup of chamomile tea and take a couple Benadryl. I'll probably sleep fine. She considered that for a second and then asked, How about you? Will you sleep? I might commune with a double shot of Jack Daniels before bedtime. I think that Jack and I will do all right tonight. Jack hadn't stopped the nightmares that started in Iraq. Now I feared that one more nightmare had just added itself to the list. Jenny gathered Jeremy's bag and belongings and headed him to the door. I got a brief goodnight kiss. At least tomorrow is your day off, she said. You can sleep in. As I watched Jenny's taillights disappear down the street, I wasn't as confident about Jack Daniels holding the answer to the hollow feeling in my chest. I watched the red numerals flash 2 a.m. before I could close my eyes and not see an image of Axel lying on the floor. Whistling Pines, Chapter 3. Monday. I woke at 4 o'clock, drenched in sweat. A vision of Axel standing next to my bed had asked me, Can you find him? I lathered my face and started to shave, but my hand was shaking and I sliced my chin. I watched the blood trickle through the white shave cream as I gently set the Bic razor next to the faucet. I grabbed the edges of the sink with both hands and stared into my own bloodshot blue eyes in the mirror. Maybe a couple fingers of Jack Daniels wasn't the best plan, or maybe finding Axel by my bedside is dredging up too many ghosts, I said to the mirror. Having seen too much death and having escaped the bullets and bombs of Iraq, it seemed stupid to be so rattled about Axel's death. I took a deep breath and closed my eyes. Straighten up, sailor, I said to myself. I brought a vision of Jenny's pretty face into my mind, washing away the swirling images of Iraq and Axel's apartment. My hands were suddenly steady, and I finished my shave without another cut. I stood under the shower and let the water pound the knots out of my shoulders. When the hot water ran out, I toweled off and ran a comb through my damp hair. My eyes looked better, but my stomach was protesting the greasy supper, the whiskey, and the short night. I started to put on a T-shirt and reconsidered, moving to my usual work outfit of a golf shirt and khaki slacks. It was my day off, but I needed to go to Whistling Pines. Axel wanted me to find his killer. I found a few cans of Mountain Dew in the refrigerator and drank one in 3 gulps as I reran the vision of Axel by my bed. I knew it was Axel, although I couldn't say that I'd seen his face. What disturbed me more was the question, Can you find him? Was his murderer a man? Was my subconscious biased to assume that Axel's killer was a man? Had Axel spoken to me? I trimmed the mold from a slice of bread and toasted it. I decided that I'd had a nasty nightmare and that Axel's ghost had not been in my bedroom. I smeared the last crusty remnants from a jar of strawberry jam on the toast and popped another Mountain Dew as I tried to formulate a plan for the day. My inclination was that a woman wouldn't kill Axel. It might be relatively easy to assess the feelings of the few male residents and maybe discern possible motives for murder. The visitor list wasn't all that long, and it might only take a few inquiries to find out if any of them might have cruised by Axel's apartment or if any of them might have heard the commotion. Wired by the caffeine and with somewhat of a plan to march forward, I retrieved my keys from the nightstand. Goosebumps rose on my neck as I passed the side of the bed where I'd dreamed that Axel had been standing. As stupid as that seemed, the response wasn't rational. I dashed for the car as the eastern sky grew pink in the morning twilight. Mist blew in from Lake Superior as the slightly warmer water met the colder air, creating a patch of fog that quickly enveloped my car. I briefly broke out of the veil of fog as I drove through town. Whistling Pines was close enough to the lake that the fog resumed and grew thicker as I got further from downtown Two Harbors. The building was shrouded in white mist when I turned into the driveway, and there was a surreal moment as a giant version of a log lodge emerged from the fog. The BCA's Winnebago was still sitting in the parking lot, now covered with a layer of dew, and Len's police cruiser sat in a back corner under a birch tree that would be stately when it leafed out in a few weeks, but in the cold spring fog it just looked barren and eerie. The early rising residents were filing into the dining room when I passed through the reception area on my way to my tiny office. Several of the women from yesterday's hallway incident trooped past in a group, and I caught snippets of conversation, including a few unkind adjectives preceding Axel's name. One woman with newly permed tight curls peeled herself away from the group. Virginia Ginny Jansen was a longtime resident who managed to keep abreast of politics and the news. Some of the residents had given up on the news, saying it was either bad or stupid. Not Ginny. She could talk about the political candidates and their scandals. She kept us up with state, county, and local politics, and even the current situation in the Middle East. Ginny motioned me over to a quiet spot between the aviary and the lending library. Pete, I see that there is a cruise ship sailing the Great Lakes. She put her hand on my arm and smiled up at me as the lovebirds tweeted in the cage behind us. Since you're the recreation director, I think that it would be a grand outing if we took a cruise someday. Some of the people who came to Stella Ahonen's birthday party were cruising from Erie, Pennsylvania and back. They caught a day trip up here when the ship docked in Duluth. I think a cruise ship might overextend our recreation budget, I replied. What about just a dinner cruise? I haven't worn my long dress in several years. I patted her arm and said, I think that the Vistaquin Duluth Harbor tour is more in our budget, and I think they'll let us come casual. Ginny sighed. Maybe I'll wear my long dress to Axel's funeral. It's dark blue, and it almost looks like a mourning dress if I wear a strand of pearls with it.
You've been listening to Episode 2 of Whistling Pines by Minnesota author Dean Hovey. There will be a total of 15 episodes in this reading, so be sure to tune in again next time for more from Whistling Pines. If you miss an episode during the reading of this book, you may find the previous week's episodes posted each weekend on our website, ktwh.org, under the Programs tab near the top of the homepage. Just look for Literally from the North Shore on the drop-down menu under Programs.